In this session, we're going to examine three of the favourite arguments that atheists use to seek to establish their claim that God does not exist. These arguments are what I call cosmological arguments, that is to say, they are concerned with the origin and nature of the universe as a whole, the cosmos. And we must restrict ourselves to these simply because, first of all, we don't have time to look at other arguments, other kinds of arguments, and secondly, these arguments are particularly important because they are the kind of arguments for which atheists claim the support of science. And that will be one of our concerns this morning. So we're going to study or examine these three arguments. Three arguments we're going to look at are, first of all, the we made God argument. The idea that God is an invention of the human mind. It is a figment of man's collective imagination. And we should look at that first. Then secondly, the argument that takes the form of a question. Who made God? Something that we might easily dismiss, but which has more power in it than I think theists and Christians generally recognize. And thirdly, there is the argument that God is unnecessary because the universe made itself. Now, those are the three most popular atheistic arguments today of a cosmological nature, and because they are most popular, I have to assume that they are considered by atheists to be the strongest arguments, and we shall see where they go wrong. Now, some of you may be feeling that this approach is somewhat negative. Too defensive, if you like. But let me just point out two things. First of all, when the Apostle Paul wrote to the church at Philippi in the opening chapter, he told them that he was concerned with or engaged in the defense and confirmation of the gospel. So even an apostle felt it necessary to defend, to be defensive. And in our day, I believe, that is particularly necessary because of the torrent of atheistic propaganda. If there are any atheists here, I perhaps have to apologize for using that word, but it is the word that comes to mind. The torrent of atheistic teaching that comes to us, comes to our society through the mass media, television, radio, the newspapers, comes to us even through the educational system, and even it affects some government legislation. So we do need to defend the biblical worldview, the biblical view of things, and in particular concerning the origin of the universe. Now, in doing that, I am not just going to be defensive, because what I want to show is that the three arguments that we're going to talk about actually lead the atheist into a logical cul-de-sac. And the name of that cul-de-sac is the necessity of God. So there's going to be some confirmation, some affirmation of the biblical worldview here, not simply a defense against the arguments of atheism. Well then, to our task. The first argument is this, that God is the invention of the human mind. And I can't express this argument better than by reading the opening paragraphs of the book. In an interview with John Nash for the Times newspaper, the novelist and science fiction writer Ian Banks declared himself as follows: "I am an evangelical
atheist. Religions are cultural artifacts. We made God, not the other way round. Religion is one way to explain the universe. But eventually science comes along and explains it. He continued, I can remember walking down the street in May 1963, trying to work out how the world had been formed. I thought that Sooty might have magicked it with his wand. Then I wondered what Sooty could have been standing on in this unformed universe in order to create it. And who made Sooty? That's when atheism came thundering through me. If you don't know who Sooty was, then you have to read the book. But I perhaps ought just to say that Sooty was a glove puppet who featured in a long-running children's BBC television series. He had a wand. He waved the wand and wonderful things happened. Magic wand, of course. And he also played the xylophone. Anyway, Sooty or God? Who made the universe? Well, the atheist argues that we made God. And as you will have seen, I think, from the extract, the whole argument rests upon a foundation that I am going to show you is completely false. And that foundation is that science has explained or will explain everything, so that there is no need for God as an explanation. Now, when mankind was deep in its ignorance and really knew nothing, it wasn't able to explain the universe. It wasn't able to explain the things that were happening around it. And so these very ignorant people had a very clever idea. They invented one or more gods and were able to blame God for the things that they couldn't explain themselves. A very simple solution. Well, now, that is utterly redundant, says the atheist. Now we have science which explains everything. Or perhaps it hasn't quite yet explained everything, but very shortly it will explain everything. Everything of importance will be explained by science. And that is utterly false. And it's false on two levels. First of all, it's false on the level of abstract or transcendental matters. You see, science concerns itself and indeed limits itself to the physical universe. I'm going to read you another short abstract. The United States National Academy of Sciences has gone on record with the following statement. Science is a way of knowing about the natural world. It is limited to explaining the natural world through natural causes. Science can say nothing about the supernatural. Whether God exists or not is a question about which science is neutral. They could have gone further to point out that any concepts that are abstract, that are not material or physical, lie beyond the competence of science to explain. Science cannot explain love or justice. It cannot explain morality. It cannot explain the difference between right and wrong. It cannot explain the concept of a triangle. It's a concept, it's an idea, not material. It's just a thought. And it cannot explain mathematics, on which science actually relies very strongly, because mathematics are transcendental. They are in the mind, in the realm of ideas and thoughts, And there is therefore a vast range of things which we appreciate through human consciousness that science cannot even address, cannot even begin to explain. A whole realm of things that really make life worth living. And science has nothing to say about those. Take it on the authority of the National Academy of Sciences in the United States. But there is a second level, an even more fundamental level, on which science cannot explain everything and never will be able to. Science, this is the way I usually put it, science cannot explain itself. Now, what do I mean by that? I mean that science depends upon, for its very existence, the laws of nature. Science discovers the laws of nature. It manipulates the laws of nature. It writes them down in mathematical form. But science can never explain where the laws of nature came from. The laws of nature are the bedrock of scientific explanation, and every scientific explanation must finish up by appealing to a law of nature. Otherwise, it is not a scientific explanation. Let me just give a simple example. The law of gravity, or at least gravity as a phenomenon, has been in the news recently with the discovery just over a couple of weeks ago of gravitational waves, predicted 100 years ago by Einstein, but only just this month discovered and actually observed. Now, Isaac Newton produced the first law of gravity way back at the end of the 17th century. And he was able to show that the gravitational attraction between two massive objects is given by a very simple mathematical formula. That force equals the gravitational constant multiplied by the mass of one body multiplied by the mass of the second body, all divided by the square of the distance between them. Very simple, very elegant law of nature. And yet that single law of nature explains a vast range of phenomena. It explains why planets go around the sun. It explains why apples fall off trees. It explains why wood floats on water, but iron doesn't. It explains why some of us, of advanced years, find it rather difficult to get up out of our chairs at times. And an enormous range of phenomena are explained by the law of gravity. You finish with the law. You appeal to the law, and using the law, you explain all these different things. But the law itself cannot be explained by science. Where did it come from? Why does it take the form that it does? Now, you might argue, those of you who are a bit knowledgeable about these things might say, well, didn't Einstein's general theory of relativity explain Newton's law of gravity? Well, only up to a point. It is, if you like, an improvement on Newton's law. But it still invokes things like mass. It argues that a massive object actually distorts the fabric of space and time in the vicinity of that object. Just like putting a 10-pin bowling ball on a trampoline sheet, you get a distortion. And that's the kind of thing that happens, says Einstein. And that is why things attract one another. But what is mass? What is mass? There you're getting into difficulties. The latest idea is that mass is the result of empty space actually being filled with an ocean of Higgs bosons. Higgs particles discovered just a couple of years ago, if that, at the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva. And those Higgs bosons are supposed to act like a kind of cosmic treacle. You open a tin of treacle, right? You pick up a spoon from the table, and you push the spoon down into the tin of treacle. And then you pull it out. It's ever so much heavier than it was when you picked it up from the table. Much more resistant to being lifted. Well, that's the idea. The Higgs bosons are like the treacle that prevent things, other particles, moving through or hinder them. And that is what gives them mass. Except, of course, it doesn't work for all the particles, because a photon, which is a particle of light, doesn't have a mass. So it doesn't interact with the Higgs bosons. And there's a great mystery here. And there always will be. And every time you try to explain a law of nature by another law of nature, you are still appealing to a law of nature. And it is that fact that means that science cannot explain itself, because it can never explain the ultimate laws of nature, whatever they may be. We may not have discovered them yet, but it will never be able to explain where they came from, why they take the form that they do. And so the whole argument that we made God because we couldn't explain the universe breaks down totally, because we do not have in science a means of explaining everything. In fact, science only explains a rather small corner of the experiences we undergo as human beings. And the rest of the things that we appreciate and comprehend through our conscious activity remain inexplicable by science. And so there's an awful lot left to be explained by God. Well, let me move on to the second argument. The second argument is posed as a question. If God made everything, who made God? And it's very easy for theists, among theists, of course, to simply wave away this argument and say, it's a silly question. Nobody made God. Finish. Next question. But to do that is to ignore the true force of the argument here. And in order to bring out that true power of the argument, I need to tell you a story. Now, I suspect that half of you know the story already, but just as a matter of interest, put your hand up if you know what I mean when I talk about the Tower of Turtles. Oh, well, that's not half of you. So I need to tell the story anyway. The story is a completely untrue story, but it's a very useful illustration. The story is that a little old lady, or if you prefer it, a little old man, a little old person, went to listen to a public lecture given by an astronomer on the solar system. And after the lecture, the little old person goes up to the lecturer and says, "Young man, you've got it all wrong. The Earth is not suspended in space, as you said. It is supported on the back of a giant tortoise or turtle," I say the two versions of the story. "It is supported on the back of a giant turtle." And the lecturer, trying to hide his amusement, says, yes, and what is that turtle standing on?" "Oh, standing on another turtle." Yes, but what is that turtle standing on?" "Ah," said the little old person, "you can't catch me out like that. It's turtles all the way down." Now, that is a very amusing illustration of what is known as an infinite regression. Or, if you're listening to this in the United States, an infinite regress. What it means is that an explanation that needs to be explained, and then that explanation needs to be explained, and that one needs to be explained, and so on ad infinitum, that such an explanation is no explanation at all, because it never grounds in reality. It turtles all the way down, but down to what? And the answer is nothing. And I suppose some atheists, when they ask the question, if God made everything, who made God, are actually hoping that the theist will get involved in an infinite regression and say, oh, well, this is how God came about, came to exist. And then, but if that caused God, what caused the cause of God? And you're off on the slippery slope. But I think the majority of atheists do not expect theists to be so silly as to try to answer the question. They expect theists to give, a theist, by the way, is somebody who believes in God, in case you're not familiar with the term. They know that the theist isn't going to get caught out like that. And they are actually saying something rather different. What they are saying is that the statement that the universe was created by God is actually the first step on an infinite regression. God, in their view, is the first turtle. You don't need the first turtle. You've got the universe supported in space. Why put a turtle underneath it? You don't need that turtle. You don't need an explanation of why the Earth hangs in space. And similarly, they say, you don't need an explanation of the universe. After all, the universe is something that we know exists. We all agree, or most of us agree, that the universe actually exists. And there we have some concrete object, the cosmos, that we can touch, that we can handle, that we can see, that we can experience on a daily basis, and that's all we need. Why introduce an explanation of the cosmos, replacing a physical, material, experienced thing by an invisible, inaccessible, and transcendent being called God? It's just a first turtle. And of course, once you put the first turtle in place, then you need all the other turtles. And that is the force of their argument. What it amounts to, however, in answering it, is the concept of a brute fact universe. The universe, they say, is the only reality. You don't have to propose that there is an invisible God behind this reality. Here we have the reality of the universe, and that is the reality. That is all of reality. And just as we say that you can't explain God, you can't say where God came from, they say you can't explain the universe. You shouldn't even try. The universe is a brute fact. We just have to accept that. And some of the older atheists, people like Friedrich Nietzsche, the German philosopher, and Bertrand Russell, a British philosopher, and many others, did subscribe to this concept of a brute fact universe. That is reality. That's the only reality we need. But the brute fact universe is out of fashion. It's gone out of fashion for two reasons. First of all, the human mind won't accept it. The human mind is incurably curious about the universe in which we live. Almost the first thing a child asks when it begins to think is this: Mummy, where did I come from? The child is not, in fact, asking for a lesson in reproductive biology. The child is asking, where did I come from? The child has become aware that it is a person different from other persons. and the child is now conscious of the uniqueness of itself. And when the child asks, where did I come from? That is the question that is being put. Where did I, as an individual, as a person, come from? And that is just an example. The entire scientific endeavor is grounded in the curiosity of man about the place he finds himself living in, about the universe, about the cosmos. And just think of all the things you read in your daily newspaper or hear about on television about science. Most of it is directed towards seeking an understanding of the universe around us and our place in the universe, because you get different answers. But nevertheless, the endeavor of what we call pure science is driven by this curiosity. The human mind is not willing just to sit back and say, well, it's a brute fact universe, there's no point in exploring it, there's no point in explaining it. It is reality, you can't explain reality. Just take it or leave it. So there is a serious problem with the brute fact universe concept. But not only is it something that the human mind doesn't like to entertain, it is also something that has been effectively disproven by science itself. For during the last 70 years or so, it has become a recognized fact among the majority of scientists, not all, the majority of scientists, that the universe had a beginning. Now, I say a lot about that in the book, and I don't have time this morning to develop it. So we'll just take it there. You've all heard, no doubt, of the Big Bang theory of the origin of the universe. The fact that if you take this universe, which we know to be expanding, and go back in time, it will contract and contract and contract until the entire universe, including all of space and time, is smaller than a pinhead. Then, after that, it must have got even smaller. And it finishes up in what is called a singularity, at which the laws of nature no longer function, they no longer operate. You cannot discuss a singularity in scientific terms. Now, there are a lot of scientists who are trying to get around this because they don't like the theological implications. But nevertheless, the overwhelming consensus of scientists today is that the universe had a beginning. Until Einstein dropped a big stone in the pool and advanced his theory of his general theory of relativity, people did actually think, scientists did actually think, that the universe was eternal, never had a beginning. But we now know, through science, that it did have a beginning. And science has eventually, in the last 70 years, caught up with the opening words of the book of Genesis. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The universe had a beginning. So then, the brute fact universe is no longer accepted, although there are people who are trying to work out theories which show that the universe did always exist, but perhaps in just a seed form. And we don't have time to go into that. But we know that that theory of brute fact universe is no longer acceptable, because the leading atheist scientists of today are writing books such as the recent book, 2013, I think it was published, by a man called Lawrence Krauss, which has the title, A Universe from Nothing. And indeed, that is the idea that Stephen Hawking advances. and we'll look at that in just a moment. A universe from nothing. They acknowledge that the universe had a beginning, and that before the universe there was nothing. And this brings us to our third argument, and that is the only argument the atheist can put forward, having accepted that the universe had a beginning. The only argument that he can advance is that the universe created itself. And that is the third argument, great popularity and gaining ground among atheists and probably among a lot of other people. I have another slide, the next one, which is a quotation from this book, which was published in 2010 by Stephen Hawking and his co-author. Stephen Hawking, I'm sure, is a familiar name to you, a brilliant cosmologist who suffers from motor neurone disease and whom you see on television seated in his electrical wheelchair and speaking with a synthesized voice. A man to be highly admired, a man of great achievements and attainments. But in this book, he came out as an atheist, which he had not previously done. And this is his argument. I think you can see it there. Because there is a law like gravity, he writes, the universe can and will create itself from nothing. Spontaneous creation is the reason that there is something rather than nothing. Why the universe exists. Why we exist. It is not necessary to invoke God to light the blue touch paper and set the universe going. Well, they obviously have taken on board the fact that the universe did have a beginning. And they are trying to explain that beginning without any appeal to God, to some spiritual realities, to some non-material, non-physical entity that created the universe. That they cannot accept. That is quite contrary to their worldview. And so, obviously, they have to find an alternative explanation, because if something begins to exist, it needs to be explained. Something must have caused it to begin to exist. And we have in this quotation, which is why it's such an important one, a statement, really, of the way these people seek to explain how a universe could create itself from nothing. Let me read again. Because there is a law like gravity, the universe can and will create itself from nothing. In fact, Hawking and the others appeal to more than the law of gravity, but the essence of what they're saying is that the laws of nature, or certain laws of nature, pre-existed the universe. Now, that is an interesting statement in itself, because what are the laws of nature? What do we mean by the laws of nature? Are they not simply a description of the way the universe works? And what these people are saying is that there was a description of the way the universe works before there was a universe. So that in itself involves a leap of faith, I would say. But let's assume that they're right. Let's assume that the laws of nature, or certain laws of nature, gravity and a number of other things, the laws of quantum mechanics in particular, let's assume that they did exist before there was a universe. The question is, where did they exist? In what medium did did they exist? They weren't written down on paper because there wasn't any paper, because there was no universe. They weren't on a compact disc because there were no compact discs, because there was no universe. There was nothing, absolutely nothing, of a physical and material nature. No matter, no energy, no space, no time. Nothing. But the laws of nature, or certain laws of nature, pre-existed that in order that they might create the universe. Because there is a law of gravity, or like gravity, the universe can and will create itself from nothing. Now that's quite a difficult question, isn't it? Where did these laws exist? Now, one critic after I gave this lecture on another occasion in another place said the laws just existed. They didn't have to exist anywhere. They didn't have to have a location. They didn't have to exist in a medium of some kind. I pointed out that if the laws of nature were true, as they had to be in order to create the universe, they had to exist in a realm called truth, and that was distinguished from another realm called not truth, or error. So even if you follow that argument, you come to the necessity of a mind. Because the only place that the laws of nature could have existed before there was a nature to give them a home was in the mind of God. Now, I don't know whether anyone here has ever bought a house off plan. Buying a house off plan means buying a house before the house is built. Buying a house on the strength of the architect's plans. You look at the plans and you commit to buying that house. You probably put a big deposit down. You buy the house before it exists. Now, if there are no paper plans, if there are no compact discs, if there is no medium of a physical nature in which to record the architect's plans, where can they exist? There's only one place they can exist, and that is in the mind of the architect. And therefore, it follows that the arguments that we've been pursuing lead you to the conclusion that there must be an architect who is not physical, who is not material, who is a mathematical genius, because all the laws of nature are ultimately mathematical. There must be an architect who has those certain basic properties. And that architect, of course, the Christian would claim, is the God of the Bible. Now, I have time to just make a short postscript, because when these people talk about nothing, they're getting nothing confused with nothing, which is quite a feat of mind in itself. What they mean by nothing is simply empty space. Now, I mentioned earlier on the current view is empty space isn't empty. You take all the matter and energy out of it, you've still got something that has dimensions. Space. And you've still got all those Higgs bosons which are flooding space in order to make other objects and particles have mass. Nothing is not nothing in their view. They are in fact appealing to a vacuum. They're not appealing to a genuine nothing. A vacuum has dimensions, and it has a capacity, it has a certain intrinsic energy. We know this. It can create what are called virtual particles, spontaneously appearing and then disappearing by annihilating one another. We know these things are true. An empty space in this universe is not nothing. But when we say, or when the Bible says that God created the universe ex nihilo, out of nothing, talking about a completely different kind of nothing. That completely different kind of nothing is something that has no physical existence, no material existence. It is a spiritual realm. And the Bible calls it eternity. Isaiah 57, verse 15, says, "Thus says the high and lofty one who inhabits eternity. I dwell in the high and lofty place with him also that is of a contrite and humble spirit." So when they talk about the universe being created from nothing, it means really that they already have to have space and time. They already have to have Higgs bosons. They have to have a very full and very busy something. And then they say they can create a universe out of it. But in that nothing, as they see it, all the necessary laws of nature already exist. No problem. What they cannot explain is a genuine creation of the universe from nothing. For that we need God. And their own arguments drive them into this cul-de-sac, which I say is the necessity of God.